Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Robots Are Coming. And today, we will be interviewing Professor Hubbard, professor of law at the University of Chicago Law School, and he's also serving as the editor of the Journal of Legal Studies. You've taught classes in civil procedure, and you've been an organizer for the Law and Economics Workshop. Your current research focuses primarily on the economic analysis of litigation, courts, and civil procedure. And without further ado, my name is Ken Hinn, your host with The Robots Are Coming. Let's get started. To start off with, can you tell me a little bit about what you did before you got your role at the law school and what was your research interests?
Great. Thank you, Ken, for the introduction. And it's great to be here on your podcast. I'm a professor of law at the University of Chicago Law School. I received my JD from this same law school back in 2000. At the time, I was executive editor of the Law Review. I then clerked for a federal circuit court of appeals judge, Patrick Higginbotham, the U.S. Circuit, Fifth Circuit. And after that, from 2001 to 2006, I practiced law as a litigation associate at a law firm called Mayer Brown here in Chicago. I specialized in commercial litigation, electronic discovery, and appellate practice. After completing my PhD in economics, I joined the faculty at the University of Chicago Law School, where I've been teaching ever since.
Awesome. And you are a professor among the best and most prestigious law school in the world, the University of Chicago Law. And as you mentioned, you have dealt with commercial litigation and electronic discovery. And that's why I wanted to delve into your paper called The Discovery Sombrero and Other Metaphors for Litigation in 2015. That's a great name, the Discovery Sombrero. So first, let's discuss the process of discovery within civil litigation. So from what I found, civil litigation is when two or more parties are seeking monetary damages or specific performance, and the case doesn't involve any criminal accusations. From your perspective, Professor, how does it work when we combine both discovery and civil litigation? What does that look like?
Discovery is a really important part of the civil litigation process in the American approach to litigation. A case can begin when the plaintiff actually has very little understanding of the key facts that may end up proving their case. And the discovery process allows both parties, the plaintiff and the defendant, to gather information relevant to their case, including by asking their opposing party to provide them with documents or data that may be relevant to the arguments they want to make in the lawsuit.
And within that lawsuit, there's another layer of obscurity. So we have to consider that a lot of lawyers, technologists don't know a lot about the timing, volume, and cost of discovery in a civil justice system. While many lawyers have the knowledge of their own experiences, what have commentators in this space struggle with?
You point out a really important issue in the study of civil litigation, civil procedure, and discovery in particular. And that is, while lawyers have tons and tons of anecdotal evidence about the costs of discovery and things that might work well or work badly in discovery, there's actually very little in the way of organized empirical data on discovery. And so what we don't have is a coherent empirical picture of the overall patterns of costs associated with different parts of the civil litigation process, including discovery.
And from a policy standpoint, what sort of collective ignorance might there be from judges?
Judges know even less than commentators like myself do. Although the attorneys in lawsuits have a lot of understanding of what their expenses are, what they're finding, what they're not finding, how much time the discovery process takes. Judges are not involved in the discovery process basically 99% of the time, which means judges don't have a good sense of where the pain points are in the civil discovery process. And as a consequence, they're really hamstrung in their ability to design rules that work well for everyone because they just don't know how much discovery costs. They can't see that in their own day-to-day work as judges.
And it seems to me like the ignorance of how discovery tends to play out, which many technologists, attorneys, and judges alike tend to do, leads to even more confusion at the doctrinal level. Shouldn't federal courts around the country take a stronger stand to address perceived problems with discovery?
I think federal judges, many federal judges at least, do want to take a stronger stand in terms of helping control the costs associated with discovery and helping the discovery process run more smoothly and effectively for the parties before them. It's also the case that the committees of judges who work to draft the rules, to amend the rules of civil procedure that control discovery, also care a lot about getting the rules right, making the rules work better. But because of their ignorance about the costs associated with discovery, what works and what doesn't work, they're often held back in either their ability or their willingness to take steps to reform or amend the rules. They're not quite sure what to do. One dramatic example of this that often comes up in my own teaching is a case called Bell Atlantic versus Twombly. It's, at least among lawyers, a very famous case. The Supreme Court spent a lot of time in its opinion talking about its concerns about the discovery process and how the discovery process can be expensive for parties, or how the discovery process can be misused by litigants in order to win cases that they shouldn't be winning. But the funny thing about the Bell Atlantic versus Twombly case is the Supreme Court actually did nothing to interpret, create, modify, improve the rules governing discovery. It was a case about pleading standards. In other words, the rules governing when you can dismiss a complaint that's been filed by a plaintiff in court. So even in a case like that, where the court's paying attention to its concerns about discovery, it's not identifying how to fix discovery. Instead, it's looking at other aspects of the rules and trying to fix those for better or for worse.
And I'm really surprised that in a case like Bell Atlantic versus Twombly, that they made no use of the rules governing discovery. And in today's world, Professor, what is the most significant discovery-related issue among practitioners of the law?
I think the answer to that question would really depend on which practitioners you ask. And one of the things that makes studying discovery both difficult and very exciting is the role that technology plays in discovery today. Technology has completely revolutionized how lawyers do discovery, both in terms of the fact that what you're looking for is now all in electronic form, when 20 years ago, much of it was in paper, as well as how you're looking for it is now being done through the use of various machine learning techniques, all sorts of advanced software. While in the past, when I was practicing law, a lot of it was still being done by attorneys, including myself, looking through boxes of paper documents, trying to find which documents look the most relevant. So things are changing rapidly, and technology is playing a huge role in those changes. One of the changes that is important is a really important part of the civil litigation process in the American approach to litigation. A case can begin when the plaintiff actually has very little understanding of the key facts that may end up proving their case. And the discovery process allows both parties, the plaintiff and the defendant, to gather information relevant to their case, including by asking their opposing party to provide them with documents or data that may be relevant to the arguments they want to make in the lawsuit.
And within that lawsuit, there's another layer of obscurity. So we have to consider that a lot of lawyers, technologists, don't know a lot about the timing, volume, and cost of discovery in a civil justice system. While many lawyers have the knowledge of their own experiences, what have commentators in this space struggle with?
You point out a really important issue in the study of civil litigation, civil procedure, and discovery in particular. And that is, while lawyers have tons and tons of anecdotal evidence about the costs of discovery and things that might work well or work badly in discovery, there's actually very little in the way of organized empirical data on discovery. And so what we don't have is a coherent empirical picture of the overall patterns of costs associated with different parts of the civil litigation process, including discovery.
And from a policy standpoint, what sort of collective ignorance might there be from judges?
Judges know even less than commentators like myself do. Although the attorneys in lawsuits have a lot of understanding of what their expenses are, what they're finding, what they're not finding, how much time the discovery process takes, judges are not involved in the discovery process basically 99% of the time, which means judges don't have a good sense of where the pain points are in the civil discovery process. And as a consequence, they're really hamstrung in their ability to design rules that work well for everyone, because they just don't know how much discovery costs. They can't see that in their own day-to-day work as judges.
And it seems to me like the ignorance of how discovery tends to play out, which many technologists, attorneys, and judges alike tend to do, leads to even more confusion at the doctrinal level. Shouldn't federal courts around the country take a stronger stand to address perceived problems with discovery?
I think federal judges, many federal judges at least, do want to take a stronger stand in terms of helping control the costs associated with discovery and helping the discovery process run more smoothly and effectively for the parties before them. It's also the case that the committees of judges who work to draft the rules, to amend the rules of civil procedure that control discovery, also care a lot about getting the rules right, making the rules work better. But because of their ignorance about the costs associated with discovery, what works and what doesn't work, they're often held back in either their ability or their willingness to take steps to reform or amend the rules. They're not quite sure what to do. One dramatic example of this that often comes up in my own teaching is a case called Bell Atlantic versus Twombly. It's, at least among lawyers, a very famous case. The Supreme Court spent a lot of time in its opinion talking about its concerns about the discovery process and how the discovery process can be expensive for parties, or how the discovery process can be misused by litigants in order to win cases that they shouldn't be winning. But the funny thing about the Bell Atlantic versus Twombly case is the Supreme Court actually did nothing to interpret, create, modify, improve the rules governing discovery. It was a case about pleading standards. In other words, the rules governing when you can dismiss a complaint that's been filed by a plaintiff in court. So even in a case like that, where the court's paying attention to its concerns about discovery, it's not identifying how to fix discovery. Instead, it's looking at other aspects of the rules and trying to fix those, for better or for worse.
And I'm really surprised that in a case like Bell Atlantic versus Twombly, that they made no use of the rules governing discovery. And in today's world, Professor, what is the most significant discovery-related issue among practitioners of the law?
I think the answer to that question would really depend on which practitioners you ask. And one of the things that makes studying discovery both difficult and very exciting is the role that technology plays in discovery today. Technology has completely revolutionized how lawyers do discovery, both in terms of the fact that what you're looking for is now all in electronic form, when 20 years ago, much of it was in paper, as well as how you're looking for it is now being done through the use of various machine learning techniques, all sorts of advanced software. While in the past, when I was practicing law, a lot of it was still being done by attorneys, including myself, looking through boxes of paper documents, trying to find which documents look the most relevant. So things are changing rapidly, and technology is playing a huge role in those changes. One of the changes that has been very important to lawyers, has been affected by technology, and that happily I have been able to study and get some hard numbers, some hard data on, is what's called preservation. Preservation is a relatively understudied aspect of discovery. It's the very first part of the discovery process, and it can begin even before a lawsuit is filed. The idea here is that if you reasonably anticipate that you either will sue or be sued by someone, you have a legal obligation to keep any documents or other data that might be relevant to that case that could be used in discovery to become evidence in the lawsuit that you see coming.
That's a very interesting term, and I was also wondering, wouldn't the rules in place not make it clear that preservation is within the scope of discovery?
Yeah, there is ambiguity about the relationship between preservation and the discovery rules, and that's partly because preservation often happens even in the absence of a lawsuit, even when you're not in court. And so the rules governing court procedure may not be obvious that you would even look to those rules to understand what your obligations are with respect to preserving evidence, potential evidence, when you're in court. Perhaps not surprisingly, then, the rules are also very cautious about talking about preservation, because the federal rules of civil procedure by design aren't supposed to tell people what to do when they're not in court. The rules are there to tell people what to do when they are in court. And so there's a bit of a vacuum, if you will, a legal vacuum in terms of exactly what rules, state law, federal law, procedural rules, evidence rules, other rules, what rules actually govern what should be done when there is evidence, there are documents, data, other things that may be used in court that you're in possession of, but they haven't yet been requested in discovery. When do you have to keep them? How long do you have to keep them? These are the kinds of questions that arise in the context of preservation.
I've also read up that the rules avoid any mention of preservation of documents in anticipation of litigation. I was wondering, why would the rules avoid any mention of?
Right. So the rules historically have not said anything about it and have left that question of what do the federal rules say about preservation unanswered, with that vacuum largely being filled in two ways. One is state law governing things like the destruction of evidence, you know, obstruction of justice, that concept, do address situations where a party may intentionally destroy evidence in anticipation of it being used against them in a case. But those are extreme cases, and there's lots of other situations where a preservation might be relevant. And this is where technology becomes relevant again. There are all sorts of things we do on our computers that involve creating data and then deleting it, overriding it, replacing it. And you may not even realize that that could potentially put you at legal risk, because you might just be modifying a document because you don't think you need the old version anymore. You're going to change that document. But if the old version of the document is relevant to a lawsuit that's being filed against you, the fact that you've modified that document could mean that you've violated your duty to preserve the older version of that document. And because of this, the federal courts have had pressure on them to say something about when you can and can't delete data, when you can't modify a database, for example. And in the absence of federal rules saying anything explicitly about preservation, what judges have done is they've just made up the rules, basically. They've said they have the inherent power to regulate the conduct in their courtrooms, and they will make up the rules, and they will decide when somebody has violated their duty to preserve and when the court can punish them by making them pay fines, even by deciding the case against them as a sanction for failing to preserve the data they should have preserved.
And there is going to be a lot more available data in the future and more of a rise in new technologies. So I'm really surprised to hear that judges today are really improvising in court about all these cases. And I agree there should be something done about preservation and discovery. Whether it is through more or less regulation, I'm a little bit unsure about. What do you think about the need for information, its role in preservation and discovery from maybe a legislation standpoint or a regulation standpoint?
That's a great question, Ken. And I guess I'll offer a couple of thoughts in that respect. In December 2015, the federal courts, the committees that draft the rules, they took a small baby step in the direction of some regulation. They put a small provision in the federal rules that gave some explicit guidance to courts about when it would be appropriate to punish a party for losing data, for losing electronic data when they had a duty to preserve that data, and when it would not be appropriate to punish a party for doing that. So there have been some small steps taken by the federal courts in that respect. And those steps have been very enthusiastically received by a lot of the parties in court who often find themselves doing the most preservation. And these tend to be big businesses that have lots of data, lots of email, lots of data sets that are relevant to litigation, and they need to hang on to them. So that's been one step. The other aspect of it actually is not so much legal as technological. The legal tech industry is a gigantic industry today. It's a multi-billion dollar industry, and it brings together lawyers on the one side and technologists on the other side. And over time, what I've witnessed is the development of increasingly more sophisticated and more capable technologies that simply make it easier for parties to preserve data in a way that's useful for litigation. And so part of the way that companies and other parties to litigation have responded to this uncertainty about preservation is relying on better technology, frankly, to avoid the kinds of mistakes that will get them into trouble.
And there will be a need for technologists and anyone who's listening to create those technologies that will ultimately preserve or help out in this regard. And I've also heard that the activity of the Federal Civil Rules Advisory, they had widespread calls for rules reform arising out of frustration with the patchwork of case law that's currently governing preservation and sanctions for exploitation in a federal court litigation. Professor Hubbard, could you tell our audience a bit about what that patchwork case law would look like?
When we're talking about case law here, we're talking about decisions of judges where judges are developing the rules through their own decision-making, announcing their own rules as they decide individual cases one at a time. And what we are, and what we were seeing over the past 20 years or so in terms of case law on preservation rules and when they were violated and what the consequences would be, is that courts ended up all over the place in terms of what to do about it. Some courts said, if you intentionally set out to destroy evidence, knowing that it's relevant for litigation and destroying it anyway, because you are trying to impair your opponent's ability to get to the truth, yes, that is when you can be punished by the court, but not otherwise, not otherwise. Other courts have said, well, if you're negligent, that's enough to be held accountable. And what counted as negligence? Well, that depended on the court. In some cases, you could say, well, if you knew that there was that a case had been filed, you knew this evidence existed, and yet you didn't bother to examine it. You didn't bother to set it aside in a safe place. You didn't ask somebody to make copies of it, and then it got lost. That's negligent. Other courts went even farther than that. Other courts said, even if you didn't know that you had a legal obligation to do anything about these records, even if you hadn't yet been sued, didn't know you were going to be sued, if you should have known that you were going to be sued, and you could have imagined a world in which a court would eventually find that this duty existed, that might be enough to be held accountable for failure to retain records. And there's a technology angle to this as well, actually, which is one of the terms that was used in some of this case law was, you can be punished for the willful destruction of data, the willful destruction of data. Some courts saw the word willful and they said, oh, well, that means your desire is to destroy data. Other courts, however, said, well, willful means voluntary. You did it in a voluntary act. And so, for example, if I open a Microsoft Word document that's 3 years old and I look at it and I correct some typos and then I save it and close it, I voluntarily opened that document. I voluntarily modified it. I voluntarily closed it. I may not even realize that in doing so, I changed the metadata in that document. I changed the last modified date, for example, in that document. Some courts would say that was a willful destruction of evidence because you voluntarily opened that document. To me, that's crazy. Like, that makes no sense. But that shows the ways in which that simple language like willful, when applied in a context like, you know, metadata of documents, can lead to like really crazy results in my mind. And that was part of why the Rules Committee in 2015 stepped in and said, look, we need to set a clearer standard for what is sufficient and what is not sufficient for a court to sanction a party for the loss of data, for the loss of electronic data.
What did the founding fathers have in mind when, you know, did they anticipate something like this would happen, like a Google Doc situation where you could edit metadata or even edit the podcast that we have right now? You know, I'm really curious to what you know the Constitution had and what
Yeah, how do we think about the legal traditions going back to the Constitution, even before the Constitution, that shape what civil procedure, what discovery, what litigation look like today? You know, that's a really interesting question. And I'll tell you this, the founding fathers, not only did they not know about Google, did they not know about, you know, computers or electricity or any of these things, they didn't even have a concept of discovery, anything close to what we had today. The way that litigation was conducted, most litigation was conducted in the late 18th century, there wasn't any discovery at all. If you had evidence, that's great, bring it. If you don't have evidence, too bad. You're out of luck. And so litigation today is vastly different. Forget about technology, just in terms of what the court allows a person to look for in the course of litigation is vastly different than it was at the, you know, at the beginning of our nation's history.
This reminds me of a case, Apple against California, in that case, in which California asked Apple to send over the data of some terrorists who had some information. How do judges even come up with a clear stand on something like that when it comes to things like terrorism or when it comes to the people's personal data?
There are so many questions that come up in this space, and the legal regime is evolving. And here's a great example of an area in which you have judges making case-by-case decisions, you have the federal rules of civil procedure, but you also have national security interests, you also have criminal law enforcement interests, and you have a statute passed by Congress where they are also attempting to regulate the extent to which courts can compel private parties to turn over information to the government. And actually, one of the cases I teach in some of my classes is a similar case to the one you described. It's called United States versus Microsoft. And the United States had asked Microsoft to turn over emails that were stored on Microsoft servers as part of a narcotics investigation. But those emails servers happened to be in Ireland. And Microsoft said, this law doesn't apply to emails outside the United States. I'm not turning it over. And so the federal government actually took the case all the way to the Supreme Court, trying to get Microsoft to turn over those emails. But interestingly, the Supreme Court didn't end up deciding the question, because at the same time this was being litigated in the Supreme Court, Microsoft and the Department of Justice and everybody who was involved in the litigation were also going to Congress and saying to Congress, Congress, you should fix this. Don't leave this up to the Supreme Court. Let's do this through legislation. Let's have, you know, experts draft the rules and we'll follow them. And what happened was, basically halfway through the Supreme Court consideration of the US versus Microsoft case, Congress passed a new statute. It was called the Cloud Act. And the Supreme Court said, oh, problem solved. You fixed it. We don't need to deal with this case anymore. Case dismissed.
Well, case dismissed indeed. And there's still a lot of questions that could revolutionize the cases in tech law. Once, you know, the current Supreme Court or a future Supreme Court makes a decision on this, this will change the ruling for the rest of the country. And I also want to go back to your paper. Because you do have very great titles on metaphors about various things. And Professor Hubbard, now let's move on to the metaphors that you talked about in your paper. They're very great names, such as a sombrero and these other names. Could you talk a little bit more about what you meant by that?
Sure, yeah. So I kind of had fun with this paper in terms of trying to give easy to remember, catchy names to some of the results that I found. And I had three main results, and I can summarize them quickly. The first is the so-called discovery sombrero. And what I was trying to do there was this visual image of a sombrero, something that has a really wide base. And then the top of it is kind of narrow and tall and thin. And what I mean by that is, if you look at the scope of how much data you have to deal with as you go through a lawsuit, if you start at the bottom, that's like the beginning of the lawsuit where you're preserving data, you're saving it in case you need it. That's a lot of data. That's the wide brim of the sombrero. But as you get into the discovery phase where parties are asking for data and they're giving it to each other and they're reviewing the data and they're selecting which data to actually use in the case in trial, for example, you end up with a really thin sliver of data. By the time you get into litigation, that big wide swath of data that you're preserving ends up being a tiny sliver of data and other information that's being used, for example, at the trial stage. So that's the idea of the discovery sombrero. The idea of the preservation iceberg, as I call it, is the idea that the iceberg, there's the tip of the iceberg, and then there's the body of the iceberg. And what the court is seeing in the context of preservation is it just sees the tip of the iceberg. And there's actually all of this other stuff going on under the water before you even get into litigation that makes preservation much more expensive and higher stakes. And for big companies that have to preserve a lot of data, that means a lot of money is being spent just on preservation alone. And then finally, I talk about the long tail of discovery costs. And that's the idea that when people argue about what does a typical case look like, what is the cost of discovery in a typical case? Some people would be like, discovery is so expensive. We spent $1 million in a case the other day. And other people will say, oh, look, if you actually do a survey of all cases, the average cost of discovery might be $3,000. Who cares? Why are you upset about this? This isn't a problem. And my finding is that, you know, both of these stories are actually true. They're kind of picking up on different pieces of the same phenomenon, which I call the long tail of discovery costs. And what that means is for a lot of cases, discovery really is not expensive. It really doesn't cost that much money, and it really isn't a problem. But there's a long tail of the distribution. In other words, if you look at how much cases cost and you say, oh, 1,000, 10,000, 100,000, million, 10 million, and you kind of draw out the whole spectrum of how much things cost, that tail stretches a long way out. And there may not be a lot of cases where discovery is very expensive, but when it's expensive, it is astoundingly expensive, literally tens of millions of dollars just on discovery, just in one case. So even though only a small fraction of cases, maybe 5% of cases out there, have discovery costs that run into the hundreds of thousands or the millions of dollars, those 5% of cases can account for the majority of all litigation expenses in the entire court system. And so even though it's not a lot of cases, they have a big impact on the court system, and they're worth paying attention to.
And one last question before we sign off here. From your point of view, because I know this paper was written back in 2015, how can this paper be applied now in 2022 for, let's say, legislation, judicial side of things, and law? How do you do it now and for the future for that?
Right. Yeah, great question. You know, I think, so the basic findings, although the numbers, you know, how many millions of this, how many thousands of that, of course, those are changing over time and technology is having a big effect on those. But the basic concepts, the discovery sombrero, the preservation iceberg, the long tail of litigation costs, those basic concepts are still going to hold true today. And this study was part of an effort to respond to the desire of courts to get more data, to get numbers so that they can make decisions about things like what we talked about. It's no coincidence this paper is from 2015. It was because I was answering the Rules Committee's calls for more data on the cost of preservation because they wanted to amend the rules, which they did. They wanted to amend the rules to give guidance on preservation. And the same kind of pattern is happening today. The Federal Rules Committee, for example, in fact, just in a week or two, they're going to be meeting to talk about rules governing what are called privilege logs. This is the records that parties keep when they withhold data from production to the other side. They have to keep records of that. Well, how much do privilege logs cost? Do the rules work or are they broken? Are they wasting money because parties have to include too much information in privilege logs, for example? The fact is, nobody knows. certainly not the judges who have to make a decision about whether to amend the rules. And so one of the things they're asking for is, give us some data. And I think the lesson to be learned from this is judges care about data. They want to know what's going on. And that's an important role that academics, including myself, but many others are doing this as well, that academics can serve in terms of just really helping shed light on these questions that will allow judges to make better rules for everyone.
And that's a call for both academics and a lot of technologists, data scientists out in the Silicon Valley, which there are a ton of, to support in this effort of informing academics, judges. And that's where we create a society in which we have better laws and more informed decisions. That's all the time we have left for this conversation. Thank you for coming on to the show, Professor Hubbard, for having this wonderful conversation. And thank you everyone else for listening to this episode of The Robots Are Coming. Next time we'll have more professors, academics, entrepreneurs speaking on these topics of public policy and technology. So make sure you subscribe to The Robots Are Coming wherever you're listening to, and tell all of your friends to do that as well. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Ken.